Hello, and welcome back to the History of Australia podcast. As always, before we start, I do want to acknowledge that this podcast is being produced on traditional Kaurna land, and recognise the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region. I also pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future. This week, we'll be wrapping up 1851, as the gold rushes have just begun. However, we won't only focus on those, as we'll be taking a look at the politics, disasters, and even sport that happened in this year, in what will be a very packed and very interesting episode today. Last week, we ended as the gold rush spread from its initial source in Ophir, New South Wales, to the nearby Turon River. As thousands began to stream into New South Wales, looking to try their luck in the goldfields, the other colonised realised that 1. It was highly likely that they 2. Contained gold in their territory, and 2. That this gold needed to be found quickly to try and keep too many of their colonists from leaving, while also trying to gain the benefits New South Wales was seeing. As such, on the 9th of June 1851, just before the Turon River gold find was announced, the Victorian colonial government would offer a reward of £200 to the first person who discovered payable gold within 320 kilometres of Melbourne. This offer would set up a rush of its own, as various men attempted to claim the reward. One of the most notable would be Henry Frensham, a reporter for the Port Phillip Gazette, who would set out only a couple days later in a party of 8 or so to find gold. Within 2 days, only he and H.W. Walsh would be remaining of the party, though it would also be that on that second day, they would find gold. Or, at least, they believed they had. Near Warrandyte, only 40 kilometres away from Melbourne, they stated that they found gold specimens, which Frensham provided to William Kerr, the town clerk of Melbourne. On the 14th, only a day after this deposit, various Melbourne papers would announce this gold discovery. However, when Frensham and Walsh lodged their claim to the gold reward, they would be denied. Their specimens were found to have no gold within them, and even if they had, they were apparently too insignificant to have been the size of payable gold. While Frensham would loudly and continuously claim that he was the first to find gold in that region, another find would occur in June, only 36 kilometres from the colony's main city, once again near Warrandyte. This find was discovered by a group of men, including Louis John Michel, who had apparently seen one of the pre-1850 finds of gold. Alongside William Haberlin, James Furnival, James Melville, James Hedden, and Benjamin Greening, he would begin searching for gold in early June, in a similar region to Frensham and Walsh, though this group would not find any luck initially. However, on the 30th of June, the group would find quartz, which often contains gold, and this would be given to Victorian Lieutenant Governor Charles Latrobe. Though this initial find would do little at first, Michel and Haberlin would continue searching, eventually finding a small amount of alluvial gold at Anderson Creek, only a few hundred metres before it met the Yarra River. They would bring this back to Melbourne for the reward, though they would never receive the £200 payment. These finds would simply whet an already significant appetite for gold in the colony, and by July, these appetites would begin to be sated. On July 1st of 1851, the separation of Victoria from New South Wales would become officially complete. And at the same time, James Esmond, alongside a few others, would find payable quantities of alluvial gold at Clunes, on a tributary of the Loddon River. This find, around 34 kilometres north of Ballarat, and just over 115 kilometres from Melbourne, was apparently based on Esmond being told by George Hammond Brunn that gold had been found in the area back in 1850. Esmond would return to Geelong on the 5th of July to announce his find, with the Geelong Advertiser first publishing it on the 7th. The Argus would report the next day that the long-sought treasure is at length found. Victoria is a gold country, and from Geelong goes forth the first glad tidings of the discovery. Esmonds arrived in Geelong on Saturday with some beautiful specimens of gold in quartz and gold dust in a debris of the same species of rock. The specimens have been subjected to the most rigid test by Mr. Patterson in the presence of other component parties, and he pronounced them to be beyond any possibility of doubt pure gold. The precise location of this find would be announced in the Geelong Advertiser on the 22nd of July by Arthur Clark, and this would start what is recognised officially as Victoria's first gold rush. By August, hundreds of gold diggers were encamped at the region, though others had made their way to the Anderson Creek field as well. July would also see the discovery of gold at Bungonia or Shoalhaven, Hill End, Moria, and near current day Hargrave Creek near Mudgee in New South Wales, as well as at Castlemaine in Victoria. With Esmond having sold the first gold in Victoria on the 22nd of August, around 435 grams of it, Victoria was now in line with New South Wales in regards to the gold rushes. On September 1st, the Victorian colonial government would establish their first gold license, under very much the same system as New South Wales had, with these licenses also going for 30 shillings per month, and having various regulations around them. September would become more recognisable though to colonial Victorians for the discovery of perhaps two of the most important gold finds in the colony's history. However, before we get to those, I did want to take some time to discuss what else has been happening around the continent during 1851. Back in January, Governor Fitzroy of New South Wales would be given the title of Governor General of all Her Majesty's possessions in Australia, one which, while somewhat symbolic, did give him the ability to intervene in some capacity in intercolonial affairs. Fitzroy, upon receiving this new position, would suggest to Earl Grey that he should have his governorship term extended to another 6 years, as to reflect the new position, maybe being the first New South Wales governor to actually want to stick around the colony after their term was over. Grey, having undergone various conflicts with Fitzroy over the colony and colonies, did not see any reason to accept such an extension proposal. However, Fitzroy did still have another year and a half left on his initial term when given a new position. And so how this whole issue plays out will be something we discuss later. Moving away from grand politics to perhaps something far smaller, but still very interesting, is the playing of the first intercolonial sports match. Initially organised in 1850, Van Diemen's Land and Victoria, then the Port Phillip District, would go on to play the first intercolonial cricket and team sports match in colonial Australia history, which would occur on the 11th and 12th of February 1851, on the Launceston Racecourse, nowadays called the NTCA Ground in Tasmania. Now, I know nearly nothing about cricket, despite having lived all my life in Australia. Soccer and volleyball have always been my callings. so I won't go too in-depth into this occasion for fear of getting a great many things wrong. So for anyone who doesn't actually watch cricket, feel free to join in my initial confusion before Googling how the sports works. Suffice to say, the match was keenly followed by the media back in Melbourne. And the Argus's report on the 21st of February gives us a good overview of what happened. To note, the Van Diemen's Land cricketers, called the Launcestonians, actually still used an underarm bowling technique, while the Victorian team, called the Melbourne Knights, had advanced onto the overarm bowling techniques. Despite what was viewed as initial advantage, the first innings would go to Van Diemen's Land, who would score 106 runs to Victoria's 82. The second innings did not go much better for the Victorian team, who would only score 58 runs before Van Diemen's Land would begin, needing only 36 to beat their opponents. However, they would only score 15 and were 6 wickets down out of 10 that each team gets in an inning before the match was concluded for the day due to a lack of light. The Launceston Examiner, writing a post-match report a week later, would state that by this point, neither side was confident on beating the other. The match would resume the next morning, and the Van Diemen's Land team would quickly win with 3 wickets to spare, for a final score of Van Diemen's Land 106-36, beating Victoria 82-58, with 3 wickets to spare. Such a match received high praise in both colonies at the time, and further matches would be played in Tasmania that year by the Victorian cricketers. Moving on from sport, February 1851 would see the first catastrophic bushfires ever faced across Australia. Bushfires were initially a part of normal life for the Indigenous Australians prior to colonisation, with their spread even being a benefit to their lifestyle in many places. And nowadays, bushfires are regarded as, while still horrific and terrible, a part of the usual dangers of living in country and rural Australia during the summer. However, for the colonists in the early 1850s, bushfires were not actively considered as a regular danger for those on the continent, as at this point, both floods and drought were seen as far more prevalent and dangerous. As such, the cycle which both Indigenous Australians prior to contact and many modern Australians these days understand as the precursor to bushfires was not evident to them. Heavy rains had occurred in the late 1840s, followed by droughts, continually building up vegetation before drying it out. And by 1850, this cycle was starting again. Late 1849 had seen so much rain and cold that snow had even been observed in Melbourne, a first for the colonists there, in late August. 1850 was much of the same, as high rainfall in the winter months between May to August led to drought and high heat in the summer of that year. This high heat did not abide by 1851, and in January, bushfires had already been seen throughout the Plenty Ranges. These were not completely abnormal, as a recount of the event in 1854 stated that bushfires are of an almost daily occurrence in one part or another of the Australian colonies during the summer. They arise from various causes and are, in many instances, originated purposefully, both by natives and colonists, from the ideas of utility. This, however, was not the likely cause of the bushfires, which would start on the 6th of February. Believed at the time to have been caused by bullock drivers leaving a campfire lit at the foot of the Plenty Ranges, fire would spread from here throughout the day and the rest of the week, of which the temperature was over 40 degrees Celsius or 104 Fahrenheit throughout the colony of Victoria, and during which there were strong northerly winds. Perfect conditions for bushfires to spread. While the exact details of the day are hard to pinpoint, a 1926 account in the Argus provides us with some knowledge, which it has gleaned from the History of the Colony of Victoria, written by Henry Giles Turner. In it, he recalls the 6th of February, known now as Black Thursday, the first of many black days in Australia's history with bushfires. Fires apparently raged from the Plenty Ranges to Western Port Bay, overtaking much of the forest in the Dandenong region and around Mount Macedon, before reaching areas like Wimmera and the Australian Alps. The fire would, over the week, rage throughout the Western District and reach all the way to Mount Gambier in the colony of South Australia. Fires spread at a speed overtaking that of horses, which isn't surprising to any Australian who has seen videos of just how fast these bushfires can spread, especially when we consider that the article states that temperatures in Melbourne reached 47 degrees Celsius or 117 Fahrenheit. Though whether this is true is hard to believe, seeing as Melbourne's record temperature high is noted as just under 47 degrees in 2009 during Black Saturday. Whether or not the temperature reading is correct or truthful, the effect of Black Thursday was. The red glare from the fires could be seen over the horizon of the city, and smoke had covered it whole and would reach as far as northern Tasmania. An eyewitness, Rolf Boulderwood, would go on to write that the whole colony of Victoria seemed to be on fire at the same time, and that it reminded him of Pompeii. Overall, near on 5 million hectares or 50,000 square kilometres would be burnt, around about a quarter of the whole colony. Despite the extensive fires though, only 12 known deaths are recorded, with half of these being attributed to the M'Leyland family, of which the mother Bridget and her 5 children would perish at Diamond Creek. Her husband Richard would survive with significant burns, caused an attempt to save one of the children. On the other hand, it is believed that over 1 million sheep and thousands of cattle died due to the Black Thursday bushfires, with countless other native animals likely being affected, whether caused by uncaring bullock drivers or by gold prospectors trying to burn bush to make finding gold easier, as posited by esteemed historian and emeritus professor at Australian National University Tom Griffiths, the day was a tragedy and should be remembered by us as the first in what will soon become a long line of these black days. 1851 would also be a big year politically, as transportation continued to be a massive issue for the Australian colonies, most explicitly Van Diemen's Land and Victoria. As New South Wales was essentially off-limits for British transportation of convicts following the failure of the exile system, both other eastern colonies were attempting to throw off the yoke of transportation as they saw it. We've already talked about the Anti-Transportation Leagues formed in 1850 and 51, both the less successful one, formed by Lang, Wilshire and Parkes, but also the very successful one, formed by Cowper, which swept the 1851 Van Diemen's Land elections. However, far more happens this year in regards to the political issue. February to April would see a flurry of petitions and letters sent back to Britain in regards to the issue. For instance, the Geelong Council would send a petition to Queen Victoria on the 24th of February against transportation, while on the 28th, the self-evidently named New South Wales Association for Preventing the Revival of Transportation would send Governor Fitzroy a printed argument about the issue. Why they did this, I don't know, considering Fitzroy did not get along with Earl Grey and his pro-transportation agenda. Another petition opposing the renewal of transportation in the New South Wales colony would be signed by 206 colonists of northern New South Wales in March, including in the areas of Port Macquarie, the Hastings River, and Rowlands Plains. Despite all of this anti-transportation sentiment, though, there were still some in the colony who believed that transportation should remain. In late March, Earl Grey would receive a letter supporting a modified transportation system, which contained a pro-transportation petition from 144 employers in Van Diemen's Land, including large landholders like W. Race Allison, Ronald Gunn, and John Sinclair. In it, they would state that as businessmen and landholders of the colony, they could not afford to pay the wages expected by free immigrants, and needed cheap labour to supplement their landholdings and businesses. Such a pro-transportation letter would be followed in July, when William Denison, then the governor of the Van Diemen's Land colony, wrote to Earl Grey in support of transportation. He would argue that the demand for labour was so great in the colony, in part due to many of the workers leaving for the mainland and its gold rushes, that those opposing transportation in Van Diemen's Land were working against their own interests. Specifically, he believed that the anti-transportationists should not be allowed to combine to resist a system by which only is their prosperity assured. Despite this, though, anti-transportation sentiment far outweighed the positive ones. Early April would see the petition of over 10,000 signatories sent to Queen Victoria by the New South Wales Association for Preventing the Revival of Transportation, with signatures coming from every single colony, including New Zealand, but excluding Western Australia. And when the ships the Lady Kennaway and Blackfriars arrived in May 28th and 29th, with 249 and 260 convicts respectively to Hobart, mass demonstrations were held opposing their arrival and the arrival of any future convicts. The second half of 1851 would not see this issue abate. Early in July, a major public meeting was held in Hobart to decry the British government's breaking of good faith in sending over the convicts. Well, later on in the month, four landowners in New South Wales, Patrick Leslie, member for the pastoral districts of Clarence and Darling Downs, George F. Leslie, Robert Ramsey, and Arthur Hodgson would send a letter to Earl Grey. In it, they would support transportation and go so far as to propose separating New South Wales into two colonies, North and South, where transportation would continue in the northern districts, ensuring landholders could maintain steady labour supplies during the gold rushes. Only a few days after this letter was sent, over 1,000 people would attend an Australasian League protest against transportation. Meanwhile, in August, something ironic would happen, as Governor of Western Australia Charles Fitzgerald would actually write to Earl Grey to complain about transportation. After having just gotten their wish to become a penal colony, the arrival of 300 ticket of leave men in June had caught the colony unawares, and with a minute, if not nearly non-existent police force, many in the colony were anxious at best about their arrival, forcing Fitzgerald to ask that the number of convicts transported be decreased for the time being. This whole issue would round out at the end of the year, as both the New South Wales and Victorian Legislative Councils passed and adopted legislation which opposed transportation of any kind throughout Australia, and the convict system as a whole. In essence, two of the three eastern colonies affected by the issue had stepped up to the plate by legislating against Britain. And as Governor La Trobe sent a letter to Earl Grey regarding the Victorian Legislative Council's adoption of this anti-transportation stance, it was unclear whether the home country would simply veto these pieces of legislation, or would finally give in to the colonist sentiment. What isn't unclear is the last few months of the gold rushes in 1851. After the June and July finds of Victoria, more would come in August, as the first finds near Ballarat were discovered. These would be small at first, such as when Thomas Hiscock found a small amount of gold at Buninyong, though even these would find people moving between goldfields such as the Clunes to get what they perceived as a better chance at being lucky. However, perhaps the biggest find would come in late August, when John Dunlop and James Regan found gold near Ballarat, at what is known as Poverty Point. Here, they would find a few ounces on the 21st of August while panning at Canadian Creek, having left Buninyong after little success. And the two men were determined to keep this initial find of gold a secret. However, Frensham had been following the two men, and upon noticing their work, would quickly give up the information to the whole of Victoria. As such, by early September, the Ballarat gold rush would start. And it, alongside the next one we'll talk about, are some of the most influential in Australia's history. Nonetheless, despite Dunlop and Regan finding the gold first, Frensham would actually claim the find as his own, in an attempt to gain rewards once more. As gold finds spread from Ballarat to Clunes and to Castlemaine, in an almost straight line northeast, the next find would also follow this geography. The Bendigo gold find, believed to have occurred in September 1851, is of high dispute. Near on a dozen people claim the first find, and suffice to say, it is difficult to establish who exactly it was. The Bendigo Historical Society claims that gold was found by two women, Margaret Kennedy and Julia Farrell, first in the region. While an 1890 select committee on the issue of who discovered gold in Victoria first would state that the first discoverer of gold at Bendigo is forever unknown. Even Frensham would attempt to throw his hat in the ring once more, claiming that he was the true discoverer of gold at Bendigo. Whomever it was, Bendigo would become a rush in late November, as diggers at Castlemaine began to shift over, alongside those who had already moved in from the Mount Alexander goldfields. Frensham, reporting at the goldfields under the pseudonym Bendigo, would state that around 250 miners were on site by December 1851, and by the end of that month, this number seems to have escalated to over 600. More finds would occur throughout the eastern colonies by the end of the year, as gold was found at Arrolin, Braidwood, Bells Point, and Toona at New South Wales, and Parshish, Oakey Creek, Monaro, and Hanging Rock in Victoria, with thousands, if not tens of thousands, now working these goldfields. However, perhaps the most interesting moment of the gold rush in late 1851 wouldn't be a new find, but rather the beginning of a new phenomenon. Last week, I discussed briefly and broadly the negative realities of the gold licenses on the goldfield diggers, especially considering their price compared to the average salary of many of the men in the mines. From the start, many of these diggers found the license system to be disagreeable, if not downright aggravating, though for a short period, no significant action was taken. As the goldfields began to centralize and take shape, though, especially in Victoria, such as with Castlemaine and Ballarat. The Victorian colonial government, led by Governor La Trobe, viewed the license system as a genuine way to raise revenue. Now, this concept wasn't entirely arbitrary, as many of the miners and goldfield towns had begun asking for significant increases in policing, for which the government did not have the revenue. While this is true though, the colonial government would announce in early December a change to the license system, which would see the license fee skyrocket from 30 shillings a month to £3 or 60 shillings a month. Such a change, backgrounded in the colony by the arrival of unpopular gold commissioners to the goldfields, would be the cause of the first significant action to be undertaken in those regions against the government. Anti-mining tax banners would be put on display, and a major demonstration, known as the Great Meeting of Diggers, would be held. Apparently, around 14,000 to 20,000 diggers would attend this meeting, though I am highly skeptical of this number, and of the other supposed name that the meeting had, that of the Forest Creek Monster Meeting. However, the meeting did happen, and it does seem effective, as soon after, La Trobe would cancel the proposed changes. As such, in the grand scheme of things, the diggers had managed to strike first against the colonial government, in what will become an ever-present, ongoing, and a highly tense political conflict between the two parties over the next few years. This week, we took our time overviewing Australia during 1851. With the gold rushes barely out of their infancy, many changes were apparent throughout the colonies, as intercolonial initiatives begin, and the push against transportation seems to be coming to its end. The gold rushes and the issues they cause are only just beginning. Next week, we'll continue the story of the goldfields into 1852, as they go from a colonial and continental affair to one that is truly international.